You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check out a program that takes art on the road into communities all over Milwaukee. Now, during the first annual State of Black and Brown Wisconsin address, several members of the newly established Black and Latino Caucus in the state legislature outlined challenges facing Black and Latino Wisconsinites. Among the lawmakers' concerns were disparities that minority children face in the state. Those include unequal access to education, health care, and higher rates of incarceration in the juvenile justice system. Our next guest is here to talk about those disparities and what the state can do to turn things around. Senator LaTanya Johnson is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 6th Senate District, which includes Milwaukee. Senator Johnson, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, big picture, why do you see Wisconsin as a poor place to raise Black and Latino children?
Because the disparities among those racial lines compared to their white counterparts is so large. For example, when you talk about poverty among children of color and children and white children, in 2014, statistics showed that 49% of African American children were living below the poverty level, 35% for Hispanic children, but only 11% for white children. And we know that poverty is the gateway to almost all disparaging statistics among children of color and white children, because those children lack the resources necessary to move them out of poverty.
And is this something you hear from your constituents about, these gaps here in Wisconsin?
Not only is it something that I hear, it's something that I see. As the senator for the 6th Senate District, I have the privilege of representing one of the richest districts in the city of Milwaukee, which is the Wisconsin Center District, but also one of the poorest zip codes in this state, which is 53206. And to look at some of those neighborhoods and to know that the children that are living in those neighborhoods, their outcomes are going to be so different from, say, a child living in 53222 versus a child living in 53206. And a child's zip code should not dictate their opportunities for success.
Let's get into some possible legislative solutions and break it down into some different areas. First of all, economic disparities. What, on the state level, what can be done to help address some of these gaps?
There's a lot that can be done on the state level. We can pinpoint those areas and those zip codes, and not just for our inner city communities, but also for our rural communities that are hardest hit by poverty, and target our resources toward those areas. I'm happy to say that MATC and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, their Promise Scholarship and their Bucky's promise to give these children access to free education, higher education, is huge, because we know one of the hurdles for children living in poverty to be able to access higher education is money, and eliminating those barriers are something that we can do. Also, pinpointing professionals to help deal with those populations, whether that has to do with trauma-informed care, changes to their environment to make sure that they have adequate health care, and just the provisions that they need for daily life, such as making sure that they have adequate housing. We see so many children, especially in the city of Milwaukee, who are impoverished, also living in dilapidated housing. And those houses, are infested with lead paint, lead pipes. They're in unsafe neighborhoods. Just making sure that all children have access to housing, but quality housing, and making sure that we do something to combat the homelessness and the eviction rate.
You mentioned higher education. How about K-12 education? Are there changes that need to be made there?
Yes, there are, because so many of those impoverished neighborhoods, their property values are significantly low. You see a higher amount of foreclosures, vacant housing. So those schools can't pull from those resources. Making sure that we don't leave our private partners out, making sure that the state is doing enough to foster those relationships, because Milwaukee has phenomenal businesses that are in that area that could help out with the poverty in the schools. But we need to remember our rural schools, too, because they see a lot of poverty as well, even though the population for minority kids are not as high as, say, the city of Milwaukee or Dane County or Racine.
You've mentioned similar problems in rural and urban areas. Do you see something that do you see things you can work on maybe with rural lawmakers, maybe even Republican lawmakers who represent those areas?
I do. Loan forgiveness programs would be wonderful in those areas. We know for a fact that this state lacks teachers. We lack psychiatrists, psychologists. We lack social workers. Making sure that the students that we attract here for higher education at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee or the University of Wisconsin-Madison, making sure that we do things to keep those students here. Loan forgiveness is huge. Our student loan rate is so tremendous. Making sure that these kids can come out and be able to work, but also get some of that loan debt paid off would do a significant amount to make sure that we can keep those professionals here once they obtain those degrees.
We're talking to Senator LaTanya Johnson from Milwaukee, looking at disparities, economic, educational, and other, between people of color and white people, children in particular. And a big issue, Senator Johnson, in recent years, really, is juvenile detention, the controversies at the Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls. Changes, it looks like, are in the works. What are you seeing going on there?
Well, we're hoping that we can get Lincoln Hills closed as soon as possible for our juveniles. One key to making sure that the recidivism rate is not high for juveniles is access to programs that will change that behavior and help to combat some of the environments that these children come from. The one thing that we do know is that 30% of individuals in adult prisons have spent some time in foster care. But when you look at your juvenile detention rates, it's even higher than that. It's upwards of over 50% of kids have spent some time in our foster care system. So making sure that our foster care system works so we don't see those children in juvenile detention, and making sure that if those children do get to our juvenile detention system, that they have adequate programming to make sure that they don't go on to our adult prison system. So making sure that we make corrective measures to Lincoln Hills is extremely, extremely important. And we want to create some type of system that will allow those families to be able to visit on a regular basis, because that's going to be key to making sure that those kids do not become repeat offenders.
One other disparity we've seen studies on over the last 5-10 years is in health. Are there issues in health disparities that you're looking to tackle?
Yes, there are, especially in infant mortality rates. When you look at African-American children, they account for 24% of infant mortalities, but they only account for 10% of the total births. That's huge. A study in 2010 said that white people in Wisconsin experienced an infant mortality rate of 4.9 deaths per 1,000 live births. But when you look at African Americans, they experience 13.9 deaths per 1,000 live births. So that's huge. This disparity among our infant mortalities are significant, and they are not something that you should be seeing in a productive city. And it's something that needs to be challenged.
We've talked about education, health, incarceration, economics. We see studies again and again over the years showing large disparities in all of those areas. Do you feel like there's a sense of urgency in Wisconsin to deal with these problems?
I don't see a sense of urgency to deal with these problems, because these problems didn't develop overnight. They started with a slow trickle, and now they've just grown to an enormous scalp that's staining this state's record. When you look at nearly 90% of all African Americans in this state live in only six counties. That's Milwaukee, Dane, Racine, Kenosha, Rock, and Waukesha. Just six counties. We should be doing better than what we're doing, but we're not. And the question is why. I think that for a very long time, for at least the last 8 to 10 years, we have neglected to make sure that these individuals and these basically races get the help that they need to become productive members of society and contribute more than what they, more than what, to reach their full potential. I'll just put that out there. And we know that our minority populations are growing. They're growing significantly, and they're growing at a fast pace. So we need to make sure that the resources are there. And for whatever reason, I don't think that this body has done enough to make sure that those resources are available.
Earlier this month, you and some of your colleagues from the Black and Latino Caucus in the state legislature, what are you hoping to accomplish with this new caucus?
We're hoping to tackle some of these very difficult issues. I know for myself, as an elected official, I take these numbers very seriously. I take them seriously because I don't want to live in a state that shows preference to one race over another. But I take these numbers to heart because the children that these numbers are affecting look like me. And so it's my responsibility to make sure that we are doing more, and I'm trying everything that I can. Now, that's not to say that we aren't doing anything. We are. But are we doing enough? The answer is no.
Senator Johnson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's State Senator LaTanya Johnson, a Democrat from Milwaukee. She joined us to talk about issues facing Black and Latino children in Wisconsin and what the state can do to turn things around. Now, the Milwaukee-based nonprofit Artists Working in Education is celebrating their 20th year as an organization. One of their programs is the Truck Studio, which consists of four colorfully painted vans that transport artists and supplies to Milwaukee County parks and libraries. We have three guests with us now. Raina J. Johnson is Donor Stewardship and Storytelling Manager for Artists Working in Education. And we have two of the artists involved in the Truck Studio, Luther Hall and Ariana Vaith. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Raina, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about how the Truck Studio works.
Hey, sure. Thank you for having us on today. So the Truck Studio, like you said, is a mobile art program where we have a fleet of four vans that are hand-painted, and we pack them with art supplies and a team of artists. And throughout the school year, we go to all of our Milwaukee Public Library branches. And in the summertime, we're at about 18 or 19 different Milwaukee County parks and playgrounds. And we provide drop-in free art activities for children between the ages of about 4 to really 24. And it's a really a great opportunity for youth to express themselves and also just create art and take something home with them that hopefully they can recreate at home.
And Raina, do I have this right? This was started back in 1999?
Yeah, that's right, Rob. So we are celebrating our 20th anniversary this year as an organization. We have a lot of exciting events happening and things that we have going on to celebrate throughout the whole year. We started this year in January. We had a birthday party with the Betty Brin Children's Museum, and that was really fun. It was a really great opportunity to sort of connect with the Betty Brin Children's Museum and also just their patrons and really celebrate the arts. There was a lot of performance art that night as well, and we had youth come to our table, and they made really, really amazing, intricate, detailed birthday party hats.
Fun. Well, I want to bring the artists in now. Let's start with Luther Hall. Luther, can you tell us about some of the art programs you've done with this Truck Studio?
Oh, sure. Like Raina said, we've done a lot of work at the libraries. Recently we did something where we were teaching kids to make hats as a form of telling a story or expressing themselves and kind of helping kids be instilled with a sense of identity. Yesterday, as a matter of fact, we did something called feeling paintings, which kind of was an exploration into abstract expressionism with kids.
Wow.
So I thought that was really, really fun. It was especially fun for me because it was kind of therapy for me. So I think I get the most enjoyment from that because I learned so much more from the kids that I work with at the libraries than I think any adult in a formal education setting could ever teach me. They teach me to think outside of the box. So I have a really great time with the kids and connecting with them and getting to know their interests and the things that inspire them. The most important drive for me, I think, is the fact that we're giving kids an opportunity to express themselves and to find outlets for expressing emotions like rage, anger, fear, love, friendship, and things like that. So the Truck Studio is a great opportunity for that.
And Ariana, let's bring you in on that point. How do you see kids expressing them, at working with them as an artist?
I think what AWE really does is it teaches a lot of young kids to think creatively. So making these art projects are really clever ways for us to get in conversation with young people on their level, on their terms. And it's outside of school, and we're making objects, we're making things, but we're also having conversations with each other, and we're having fun, and we're realizing it's fun to create things and have just like that good-natured atmosphere where all we have to worry about is making the work in front of us and hanging out with each other and being respectful.
It's not a chore for a grade, it sounds like.
No, it's no chore. No one's made to do it. It's just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Luther, has this changed the way you tackle your own art?
Absolutely. I keep going back to yesterday because it was a mind-blowing experience. The use of the materials, I'm so used to, I'm more of an illustrator and an animator than and a painter than I guess I'd say like maybe someone who works in 3D or something like that. But there's always room for expansion. And yesterday we did a project where we were doing the feelings projects. And there was some tissue paper. And I never thought of using tissue paper as a medium to actually put pigment onto a piece of paper. One of the interns I was working with, she showed me, and I was just blown away. They also teach me, like, you don't have to draw form all the time. You can focus on how you feel and let the just use the medium as the vehicle for getting a message out. And these kids always blow my mind when they come up with creative ideas, and getting insights on how they think just as much as what they're thinking about is crucial for me kind of expanding what I do as a visual artist. So this is, it's awesome. It's wonderful. It's like the best job I've ever had, basically.
And Raina, how can people in the community find out when the Truck Studio is coming to a place near them?
Oh, that's a great question. So people can find out about us through our website, which is awe-inc.org. We also have a very active Facebook and Twitter accounts, Instagram as well. And we post our Truck Studio schedule on our website. And also, if you are in the Milwaukee area, check out your local Milwaukee Public Library branch. They have all the flyers for the locations. And currently, we're actually running a crowdfunding fundraiser to buy a new van so that we can do more programs, be out at summer concerts, and more parks and playgrounds. So that's also happening right now until the end of March. We're looking to raise $7,500 through that fundraiser.
Well, thanks to all three of our guests. We've been talking to Raina J. Johnson, Donor Stewardship and Storytelling Manager for Artists Working in Education, plus the artists involved, Luther Hall and Ariana Vaith. They're both Truck Studio artists. We've been hearing about the 20th anniversary of Artists Working in Education in Milwaukee. Now, the Duluth School District decided earlier this month to remove two classic novels from its high school curriculum, in part because of their frequent use of racial slurs. Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird will still be available in school libraries but won't be taught during class. The Duluth chapter of the NAACP says it supports the move, saying that the novels are a detriment to students of color. Critics say the decision may sanitize history and make students less likely to read the influential books. It's the latest in a long history of the controversy for these novels and how to handle the N-word and other offensive language in the classroom. David Bradley is with us now. He's an award-winning writer of fiction and nonfiction. His works include the novels South Street and The Cheneysville Incident. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, what do you think when you hear a decision like this from a school district saying, hey, we're going to take Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird off of our curriculum?
Well, I mean, one of the questions we always have to ask in schools is, what is the intent of having a given text in the classroom? What are they teaching with it? And what is the sensitivity that children or students are bringing? What level are they teaching? It's a very complicated question. Just to take everything out is sort of what gets newsworthy. But my question is, well, what's the reasoning? What's the intent of having them there in the first place? What's the intent of removing them? If it's just to make the NAACP happy, I don't think that's a very good reason.
The question, if I understand correctly, you have is not so much should we teach these, but how should we teach these? How do we use these in a classroom, and what kind of classrooms are we using it in?
Well, also, why are we teaching it? I mean, the reason that you teach Huckleberry Finn has to do with irony. It has to do with composition issues. The reason the book is influential is because it confronted these issues at an early time in American literature, and many writers have learned from it. If you want to be a writer, it's a good book to read. If that's causing more problems, because now it is a historical book, which means that you have to explain a lot of things, and that may take up a lot of class time. There may be a better way to teach that lesson to non-professionals or to younger students. And, you know, how you teach it is very important, but a real question is, what are our pedagogical goals? Why do we pick any book? Not just the ones that come to our attention because of some political aspect of the book, but you know, why pick any book? Why is anything on the curriculum?
And you've worked with schools on dealing with these exact issues, including how and when to teach Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird. What kind of questions do you bring to the table? What kind of advice do you give to school districts as they consider how to teach these books?
Well, the first question, especially with Huckleberry Finn, but the first thing is that the book should not be read aloud. Most of the hurt and harm that historically that people going back now 40 and 50 and 60 years talk about is having the word nigger spoken aloud by an authority figure, which makes it seem like it's okay. And that's really the first pedagogical situation. You don't do that. But beyond that, you know, what else do the students know? Do they understand what slavery was? Do they understand that this book is set at a time when every organ of society approved slavery? When Huck says, "I'll go to hell then," he's not just speaking metaphorically. That's really what he believes, because that was the message of the time. Those things have to be taught in order for the book to be understood.
Do you think it is taught that way, usually?
I have had the joyous experience of being in a classroom or a school situation where the history teacher and the history English teacher worked together, shared the students, went back and forth, team taught the class, and those students were able to understand very easily, you know, what was going on, why words were being used, why what lynching was about, what those symbols meant. I've also been in, frankly, years later in the same school, where they were reading the book aloud, and students were not only harmed but turned off for good reason. I mean, this is not an easy thing, but just to blanketly say we're not going to do that is an avoidance, and avoidance is how we got into the trouble we're in.
Talking to David Bradley, he's the author of novels including South Street and the Cheneysville Incident. We're talking about Huckleberry Finn, To Kill a Mockingbird, and how they fit into a school curricula. This after the Duluth School District said they're taking it not out of the libraries, it's still there, but taking it off the curriculum. David, suppose we are in that English class and we want a book that talks about the use of irony and that illustrates the use of irony, and we don't want to spend time on history. Is that a time to say, hey, maybe Huckleberry Finn isn't the book for the curriculum this time around?
Absolutely. I think that when the teachers sit down, I hope the teachers are the ones who sit down, but the teachers and administration sit down and decide what's going to be on the curriculum, all those the materials should work together. And if that's an aim, then there are other stories by Mark Twain that can teach the same things. If we're talking about the history of literature, however, American literature, there's no substitute. You can't get around the impact of that book. So, you know, we sit back and say, well, how important is it? Is this a class in literary history? Is it a sophomore English class? Is it an AP class? Because if it's an AP class, there's another reason, and that has to do with what's going to be expected of students when they get to college. So there's a very complicated set of questions, and the same answer doesn't apply to every grade, to every student. The other problem, of course, has to do with what's going on in the school or in the community. Duluth has a particular problem with graduating black students. And I think perhaps the desire is to have a quick fix and say, oh, this will solve the problem. But that's not going to make a difference.
Now, suppose the goal of a class is to say, hey, we want a book that talks about racism in the United States and maybe some modern-day lessons. Does Huckleberry Finn, does To Kill a Mockingbird fit into that, or should we be reaching for, I don't know, something more recent?
Well, it wouldn't be a book. I mean, and that's the other thing, is that books exist in context in any class. I've taught Huckleberry Finn. I've taught it in combination with Frederick Douglass's narrative and also Harper Lee's novel, although there's a problem with Harper Lee's novel in that we don't know exactly what she intended. It got changed in the publication process and fits into 1960 better than I think she intended it to. But anyway, when we surround books with other books, when questions are asked again and again, I mean, Mark Twain knew Frederick Douglass. So their discussion and the conversation that they have through those books is enlightening, and that's education. And sometimes people get upset, and sometimes people have, they don't go home feeling settled. But that's not the aim of education.
I think back distantly to my own high school career. You know, we were in English class for, 50 minutes a day. Is there time to do all of this with Huckleberry Finn and maybe all the other books we want to try to fit in over the course of a year?
Well, again, you're talking the course of a year. So, you know, 50 minutes a day is a long time over the course of a year. But, yeah, I mean, if you set out ahead of time and give students an understanding of we're starting someplace and we're going to go someplace else, maybe to use a historical development, maybe to throw in texts or stories that give a different point of view by the same author, so you understand what's going on. I mean, one of the things that's beautiful about Huckleberry Finn is that Huck is about the age of high school students. And that means that you can say, okay, what would you do in this circumstances? What would you do if you had this opportunity, once you understand what slavery is about, once you understand what abolition is about, is there anything in your life to a student that corresponds to slavery? Is there anything that you want to speak out against or defend somebody from? It's an interesting question.
We're talking to author David Bradley, looking at books that contain racial slurs but are a part of the American literary heritage. Books like Huckleberry Finn and To Kill a Mockingbird, they were just removed from the curriculum of the Duluth School District. It's been an issue in districts around the country. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think teaching a book like Huckleberry Finn is worth the discomfort some people feel about the language? Is it right for a school district to take it off the curriculum? How should these books be taught? And if you're a teacher, what's your take? If you learned Huckleberry Finn, To Kill a Mockingbird, you read them in school, what do you think about how it was handled in your classroom? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're talking to author David Bradley about whether schools should teach and how schools should teach classic novels like To Kill a Mockingbird and Huckleberry Finn, important parts of American literary history. They raise concerns over the use of racial slurs. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. To your calls now, Jesse is with us in Appleton. Jesse, hi.
Hi there. You know, I think the important thing isn't necessarily whether they should, but definitely the how. I think it depends on how the teachers are presenting the information and whether the teachers are comfortable having those difficult conversations. I think if the teachers plan to just pass by the racial slurs and pass by the language and pretend like it's not there, they definitely are beneficial to just remove it from their curriculum. But if the teacher plans to use it as a learning moment for that classroom and for the kids to start those difficult conversations, it can be very beneficial for everyone.
Jesse, thanks for the call. David, your thoughts?
Well, I'm... on one hand, I want to say, well, that's what teachers do. It's often that you have to deal with material that makes you feel uncomfortable yourself and figure out how to present it objectively. But, you know, an English class is not the right place to deal with teaching racial issues. An English class is the place where you deal with English issues or literature issues or language issues. If a school district wants to actually attack this problem, let's have a class. And that's what the class is about. And it's taught by people who want to confront that issue and who have thought about it. I don't know that we should require every teacher to be able to do that.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Will on the line in Neenah. Will, hi.
Hi, I'm a student at Neenah High School, and at our high school, we were actually reading a lot of these books, and although they do use vulgar language, which we especially consider vulgar today, it really gives a feel for the times.
Will, let me ask you, what was it like when you hit those words? First, were these read aloud in your class?
Well, a lot of what we read was reading it at home and things like that. Mm. However, there were portions which we read in school. And we actually did use the words that were in the book, and we did use certain words like that. And I feel like it just was still able to give a good representation of the overall book's capabilities and really what it means today.
And, Will, before I let you go, did you and your teacher have conversations about how those words fit into the time of the book?
Oh, most definitely. Our teacher had a lot of conversations with us about a lot of the language used. Anybody who's read Huckleberry Finn knows that there's a certain diction that goes throughout the entire book, and that is specifically portrayed through a lot of uses of vulgarity as well as more simplistic language.
Well, thanks a lot for the call. David, what do you think about Will's experience with Huckleberry Finn?
That kid's in high school?
Yeah, pretty sharp, yeah. We're smart people here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that was a very sophisticated understanding. I think we have to understand, though, that there are all kinds of kids in a class, and that some of those kids may not be as sophisticated and as able to deal with language that may apply to them. So that you know, we have to be careful. But yeah, I mean, that sounds like the ideal experience with this or those books. I'm still not sure what to say about the Harper Lee now that we've seen what she intended originally, which was to do something like what Twain did, which was to put it in historical context.
Will, thanks a lot for that call. And let's take one more call. We've got Justin with us in Appleton. Justin, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think that we could do a real straightforward individual vote throughout the classrooms and schools, and you'd be able to get a really straightforward answer as to how they feel and whether or not to include it within the curriculum. And I think maybe a lot of people have a nostalgic attachment and they're kind of overdue the disagreement with getting rid of it. But change happens all the time, and we use voting for lots of different things. I think,
Justin,
maybe that'd be one way.
Justin, thanks for the call. David, put it to a vote among the students, Justin is saying, about whether to use a particular book.
Well, I don't think that pedagogical decisions can be made by people who are undergoing the pedagogy. I think that you need the authority figures who to be responsible for choosing the curriculum and deciding what the goals are. What about the kids who are on the losing side of the vote? I mean, they're going to be just as hurt as anybody else. But no, I think that one of the things that has to happen with this material, with all kinds of difficult material, is for the school board, the teachers, the administration, to have a frank exchange of views about what their goals are and why they're doing it, so that it can be explained to students and to teachers, and to parents. But that's the decision that is made by the educators.
David, in our last minute or two, let's step outside the school room. I understand your Huckleberry Finn was an important book for you. Can you talk about its value today and whether we should be reading it, even if we're well past our high school years?
Well, I have a mixed feeling about Huckleberry Finn because I understand why people really don't want to teach it or don't want to talk about it, because it's a subversive book. It asks the question, what do you do when everybody is wrong? When do you say, well, slavery is wrong, even though the Constitution permits it, the Declaration of Independence is silent on it, when you know, the law protects people who hold slaves and denigrates people who try to free them. What is there in our society that is equivalent to that? And that's a question that it's hard to face, even when you're like I am in your 60s. How do you feel about the changes that are going on? How do you feel about people who have identity issues and confront you with them? And it's not that you're against them, but it takes a little adjustment. Huckleberry Finn can help you understand that.
We'll leave it there. David, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's David Bradley. He's an award-winning writer of fiction and nonfiction. His books include South Street and The Cheneysville Incident. He joined us to talk about the ongoing controversy on whether classic novels containing racial slurs belong in the classroom, and more how they're taught in the classroom, how they're handled in English class or history class. There's still time to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.